Okay, let's unpack this. Today we're digging into an analyst report, and it's pretty fascinating. It details a major infrastructure overhaul, specifically focused on backup and recovery. And we're not talking simple file copies here. This is like a whole blueprint for a high assurance system. It's really systematic.
That's right. And for you, the listener, what we want to do is pull out the key architectural choices they made. How did they build this thing? It's all about achieving what they call high assurance. The whole design revolves around physical separation and really, really restricted communication. Systematic is the word.
Right. So our mission then is figuring out how this defensive structure actually works. I guess the starting point has to be, what are you trying to protect? What were the main goals here?
Well, and this is where it gets interesting. It kind of flips the usual priorities. Often it's all about confidentiality, keeping things secret. But here, the absolute top priorities were integrity and availability. The whole architecture hinges on being able to get the correct, unaltered data whenever you need it. That's paramount.
Okay, so reliability and trustworthiness are king. Secrecy is secondary for a lot of the data. But if integrity is number one, you kind of have to assume the systems you're backing up might already be compromised, right? So how do you stop the backups themselves from getting infected?
That's really the core challenge they tackled. The backup systems, the recovery systems, they have to be architecturally shielded, protected from anything outside, even the main servers they're backing up, trying to inject bad code or, you know, mess things up. And the fundamental way they did that, physical separation first, software defenses second.
Physical separation. Okay, that makes intuitive sense. Lock the backup server in a different room, different rack, whatever.
Yeah.
But the software part, how does that work?
So the key is limiting what the backup system software does. It has to be safe from the data coming in. And it can be if the mechanisms that interpret that incoming data are really simple, really limited function. It absolutely cannot be running general purpose software. Think about it. If the incoming data stream, which might have malware hidden in it, is only ever processed by very basic embedded code, maybe just reading file headers, calculating checksums, it can't be easily tricked into running malicious commands. No buffer overflows, that kind of thing.
Okay. So you drastically shrink the attack surface. Because, yeah, usually backup software is complex, needs patching all the time.
Exactly. And they specifically thought about common attacks, like denial of service. They manage space allocation really strictly, control buffer sizes for communication. The idea is you can't just flood the backup system and crash it by using up all its storage or network capacity.
Makes sense.
And for corruption, it's almost elegant in its simplicity. You can't really push corruption into the archive permanently. Why? Because the system keeps every historical version. If the main system gets corrupted, the backup system just saves a perfect copy of that corrupted version. But it still has the clean version from right before the corruption happened.
Okay, right. It doesn't overwrite the good stuff. So that foundation of trust is built on physical separation and really limited software function. Now, how do they translate that separation into the actual network? I read something about a color-coded system. Sounds visual.
Yeah, the color coding is central, and the report is really clear on this. Assumptions are the enemy. Making assumptions about network trust is how systems get broken. So they divided everything into these distinct, isolated zones, green, yellow, red, black, each with its own rules, its own trust level, no shared assumptions.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's walk through them, maybe starting from the outside in. What about the cloud servers?
Okay, yeah. Cloud servers are the public face, designed to handle varying loads, external connections. They use a cold standby approach for disaster recovery. The goal is like 30 minutes to get back online. But the critical part, backups are pulled from the cloud servers, initiated from the internal green network. The cloud can't push data in unsolicited.
Gotcha. Pull, not push. Okay, next zone is yellow. Sounds cautionary.
It is. Yellow is the lowest trust internal zone. Think of it like the utility area, guest Wi-Fi, printers, maybe IoT devices that need to phone home to the internet for updates. It uses NAT to get out to the internet. But crucially, there's no important user data stored there. And because of that, it's not backed up at all. It's disposable.
Disposable infrastructure. I like that. Okay, so green must be where the real work happens.
Exactly. Green is the trusted internal zone. This is where the main user systems are, primary and secondary machines, all running specifically configured Linux systems. This is the core production environment.
And that leaves the vault.
Yeah.
Red.
Red is purely for backups and the data repository. The archive lives here. And its defining security feature is the network traffic flow. Red nets to green. network address translation, but only in one direction. This is so important. It means traffic can only start from red going out to green. Green systems, the production ones, cannot just open a connection into the red backup zone whenever they want.
That's a strong boundary. And then there's black.
Black is the void. Completely separate R&D network, physically air-gapped, never connects to the internet, never connects to green, yellow, or red. Ever. Full stop.
Let's dig into those NATs a bit more. The report really emphasizes them as the key separation mechanism, maybe even more than a complex firewall. Why is a NAT gateway inherently stronger in this context?
Well, think about a firewall. So based on rules, right? Policies about ports, IPs. It can get really complex, easy to make a mistake in the configuration. A NAT, especially configured like this, is simpler architecturally. It fundamentally dictates who can start a conversation. In the green to red boundary, only red can initiate. Green literally cannot send the first packet to red. It's a one-way door for initiation, much simpler, much harder to accidentally misconfigure.
And they didn't just use one type of NAT device everywhere, did they? There was something about diversity.
Oh, absolutely critical. Using different hardware, different restricted OS environments for each NAT gateway. The NAT from yellow to green might be a custom Linux box they built, doesn't update itself from the internet. The NAT from green to red, maybe it's a commercial device running a different stripped-down open-source OS. Also, no internet updates, no IPv6 allowed. So even if an attacker finds some zero-day exploit for this specific NAT device separating green and red, that same exploit likely won't work on the different device separating yellow and green. It breaks the chain.
That's clever. Fault tolerance against exploits. And I have to appreciate the simple, practical touch using colored cables. Yellow cables for the yellow network, red for red, helps prevent someone accidentally plugging things into the wrong zone.
Right. It shows they're thinking about operational reality, not just theory. High assurance needs that practical side. Human error is always a factor.
Okay, let's shift gears. Section 3 in the report gets into the nitty-gritty.
Mm-hmm.
What backs up what and how? We know yellow is out. What about green, the user systems? Given that integrity is the goal, how do they manage that?
Green has this interesting two-stage approach for user systems. First, the primary machine backs up to its secondary counterpart. But here's the twist. It's ad hoc. It's not automatic synchronization every few minutes. It's deliberate.
Why not automatic? Isn't faster usually better?
Not if the thing you just automatically copied over was malware or a corrupted file. By making it ad hoc, maybe triggered manually or by a script after checks, they ensure they only copy stuff to the secondary after they're reasonably sure the primary is in a good working state.
Ah, so the primary to secondary copy is about having a known good hot standby ready to go. Not just the latest state, but the latest working state.
Precisely. Then the second layer kicks in. The red backup system pulls backups from both the primary and the secondary green machines, usually daily, secondary first, then primary. That's the main archival backup.
Now, you mentioned something earlier, this fast restore tactic they use. Removable disks. Putting user file systems on, like small USB drives. That sounds incredibly fast for getting someone back up and running.
It is, like ridiculously fast. Machine has a problem. Unplug the user's USB drive, which has their file system, plug it into a waiting cold standby machine that's already configured. Boom. They're logged in and working again in like 1 to 5 minutes. It totally bypasses slow network restores for immediate needs.
Okay, that's impressive speed.
Yeah.
Wait, isn't that USB drive then a single point of failure if that drive gets corrupted or fails physically?
Good point. It is a single point of failure for the instant working state. But remember the layers. That drive's content is backed up daily to the red system. And even more, monthly backups from red are archived off onto separate disks stored in a fire safe, maybe even off-site. So the USB drive is purely for immediate operational continuity. The deep, robust archive in red handles the long-term protection against disk failure or major corruption. It's about separating those concerns.
Fast recovery versus deep safety. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And tell me more about that deep archive process, the Unified Historical Archive sound company.
It's definitely a slower, more methodical process. Those monthly backups get copied off. In parallel, the main Unified Historical Archive on the red system gets updated. This isn't just copying files. It tracks every unique file chunk based on its cryptographic hash, its checksum, and its length, like a digital fingerprint for everything. Building this consolidated archive can take days, even weeks sometimes, depending on the volume of changes. But once it's built and verified, it's made available read-only on the backup system. That's another integrity lock. Nobody can tamper with the historical record once it's set.
Read-only is key.
Okay.
Okay, this leads perfectly into Section 4 in the communication puzzle. We established green cannot initiate connections into red because of that one-way NAT. So
yeah.
How does a green machine tell Red, hey, I'm broken, I need you to send me my backup? Seems like a paradox.
Yeah, it does seem like one, but they solved it pretty elegantly using polling. The core principle is Red's integrity cannot be compromised by outside requests. So Red has to initiate everything.
So Red is constantly asking Green, you okay? Need anything?
Basically, yes. The Red backup system periodically polls the Green target systems. It's not looking for complex commands, just checking for the presence of specific agreed-upon files. If a Green system needs a restore, an administrator or an automated process on Green just creates a simple file, maybe called restore.request in a specific directory. That file might contain details like which files or directories to restore and from what date or time.
Okay, so Green leaves a note. Red picks up the note on its next polling cycle, reads it.
Reads the note, verifies it, and then Red initiates the rsync or whatever transfer mechanism they use, pushing the requested data out to the Green machine.
Ah, the request is passive from Green's side. The action is all initiated by Red. That maintains the one-way communication principle. Clever.
Exactly. It's fundamentally safer because Red is never just sitting there listening for inbound commands from a potentially compromised Green system. It's pull-based messaging.
And for the actual data moving, you mentioned rsync over Splash. Simple, proven tools. Avoids needing a big, complex backup agent or protocol.
Right. Minimal infrastructure. Yeah. Just need Smosh keys set up correctly. But they had an efficiency issue, didn't they? With really big files, like databases. Yeah. If just one byte changes in a 500 gigabyte database file.
Yeah, standard rsync based on whole files would have to copy the entire 500 gigabyte again, right? That's incredibly inefficient.
Totally. So they moved beyond just comparing whole files. They leveraged things like journaling file systems or maybe custom FUSC modules file system in user space. These tools operate at a lower level. Instead of seeing just a changed file, they can see the specific changes within the file. Think of it like tracking edits in a document.
Oh, so instead of sending the whole book again because you fixed a typo, you just send the instruction. Page 52, line 10, change to add to the...
Exactly that. You transmit maybe just a few bytes saying where the change is and what the new data is. It captures the sequence of changes. This drastically cuts down the amount of data flying across the network for large, frequently modified files. Makes the daily backups much faster, much less network load.
Okay, this all sounds incredibly robust.
Mm.
But it also sounds potentially expensive. Section 5 talks about relevance for the listener. What's the real cost here? Do you need a Fortune 500 budget for this kind of high assurance?
You know, surprisingly, no. That's one of the really interesting findings. The structure provides the security, not necessarily high-end expensive hardware. For the Red network, the backup servers, they often use older, retired machines. Even like 10-year-old laptops can be perfectly fine. They're not running heavy applications, just specialized, limited software for data handling and transfer. The NAT gateways, we're talking maybe under $50 for a capable device if you configure it right. USB interfaces, cheap.
So the cost isn't really in the gear.
No. The real cost they're avoiding is the cost of failure, losing critical data, system downtime. They calculated that even a minor incident could cost $1,000 or more just in lost development time. Spending a few hundred on this architecture saves potentially thousands down the line.
That makes sense. It's an investment in resilience.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it needs serious discipline to run properly. What kind of organizational maturity level are we talking about?
Yeah, this isn't a set it and forget it kind of system. You absolutely have to be operating at what's called the managed maturity level. That means you have documented, repeatable processes. You measure how well things are working, like backup times, restore success rates, and you adapt and improve those processes over time based on the measurements. And the single most important part of that, testing. Regular, disciplined testing of restorations. The report is pretty blunt. An untested backup will fail when you actually need it. You have to test restores, maybe annually at a minimum.
Okay, so managed level for the full system.
Yeah.
What about smaller places? You mentioned family offices, small investment firms, high-value targets. Is this set up right for them?
For them, absolutely. Given the value of their data and the targeted threats they face, this kind of low-cost, high-surety approach makes perfect sense. It's a very efficient way to get serious protection.
And for, say, a tiny microbusiness in this total overkill?
Probably, yeah. The full multi-zone NAT-separated architecture is likely overkill. Simple USB backups, maybe reliable cloud backups are probably fine, but even they need to reach at least the repeatable maturity level. That means having a defined process for doing the backups consistently and, crucially, testing that they can actually restore from those backups at least once a year, Just having a backup isn't enough. Knowing it works is key.
Right. That testing aspect is universal.
Yeah.
And the report ties this all back to ransomware defense pretty strongly at the end.
It really does. It's sort of the ultimate payoff. When you have systematic, safe storage of all your historical versions, and you combine that with these architectural controls, the one-way NATs preventing inbound attacks on the archive, the backup system not interpreting incoming content in dangerous ways, not updating itself from outside, you get really high protection against ransomware encrypting or corrupting your backups if the main green systems get hit. Okay, it's bad, but you just roll back to the last clean version you know exists in the Red Archive. You're confident the Red system itself wasn't touched.
That's a powerful position to be in. So we've gone from maybe messy ad hoc backups to this really unified protected system using the zones, the NATs, the quick disk swaps. It's a solid blueprint for resilience.
It really is. But, you know, there's one more angle here. This system built for robust recovery can actually be used for more than just backups. Its core capabilities unlock other possibilities.
Oh, like what? Using the restoration capability for other things.
Exactly. Think about deployment and provisioning. You have this trusted Red Archive with known good system states. You can use the restore function to rapidly deploy identical standard configurations onto new machines. Instant verified builds.
Ah, using it as a golden image deployer.
Okay. Yeah. Or change management. The Red system can act as a control gate. Maybe R&D develops something, puts it into a testing area that looks like green. But the official deployment to the real green systems only happens via a controlled restore from the approved version held in Red. Testing can't accidentally pollute the production master copy held in Red.
So it becomes a QA enforcement tool, leveraging the integrity protection that's already there.
Precisely. And you could even take the archiving further. Instead of just files, what if the archive broke down content even more, like into smaller code segments or linguistic chunks for text, all tracked by their unique checksums? You'd get massive compression potential, really fine-grained tracking of where every piece of data came from provenance, and you'd have this incredibly structured, secure data set ready for future tools like advanced searching, linguistic analysis, maybe even training generative AI models securely on your own historical data.
Wow. So you turn the backup system from just a safety net into a kind of foundational, highly structured digital memory for the entire organization.
That's the potential, yeah. Moving beyond just defense to enabling new capabilities, that's the real power of truly high assurance data management.